The Blood Doctor, written by Barbara Vine and read by Robert Powell.
Chapter 1. Blood is going to be its theme. I've made that decision long before I shall even begin writing the book. Blood in its metaphysical sense as the conductor of an inherited title, and blood as the transmitter of hereditary disease. Genes, we'd say now, but not in the 19th century when Henry Nantha was born and grew up and achieved a kind of greatness. Not then. It was blood then. Good blood. Bad blood. Blue blood. It's in the blood. In cold blood. Blood and thunder. Blood thicker than water. Blood money. Blood relations. Flesh and blood. Written in blood. The list of phrases is endless. How many of them am I going to find apply to my great-grandfather? I'm not sure if I'd have liked him, and up till now it's been essential for me to like, or at least admire and respect, the subject of the biographies I write. Perhaps this time it's only going to be necessary for me to be interested in him, and that won't be difficult. It's only because I found out that he'd kept a mistress for 9 years, and when his fiancée died, married her sister, giving her, incidentally, the same engagement ring, that I decided to write his life at all. Of course, I knew, we all knew, he'd been an eminent medical man, the acknowledged expert of his day on diseases of the blood and physician in ordinary to Queen Victoria. I knew that for his services, Victoria had given him the peerage I've inherited, and that he took his seat in the House of Lords in 1896. I knew he'd had 6 children. One of whom was my father's father, and died in 1909. But although he was distinguished in his day, an acquaintance of Darwin, and mentioned as a friend in letters from, among others, T.H. Huxley and Sir Joseph Bazalgette, although he was the first doctor of medicine ever to receive a peerage, the great surgeon Joseph Lister got one a year later, as a biography candidate, I was only keeping him in the back of my mind. In the front of my mind, I had Lorenzo da Ponte, Mozart's librettist. Now, there was an interesting history. Unfrocked priest, political dissident, philanderer, storekeeper, distiller, and professor of music at Columbia University. I could have got trips to Italy out of it, and maybe Vienna. But reluctantly, I had to give him up. I don't have enough musical knowledge. Then the letter came from my sister. Our mother died last year. Sarah has had the job, it's always the women who get it, says my wife, of sorting out and disposing of, or keeping, her personal possessions. Among them was a letter from our great-aunt Clara to our grandfather. Sarah thought it would interest me. She even wrote, "If you've given up the marriage of Figaro, man, why not great-grandfather?" I've never seen any of Clara's letters before, why would I? But I've a feeling she wrote a lot. My mother probably once had Sarah's task of sorting through her father-in-law's possessions when he came home from Venice to die, found the letter, and simply neglected to throw it away. It makes me feel a bit uneasy, disquieted, and at the same time slightly excited to notice the way Clara, his 4th and youngest daughter, refers to her father not as father or dad or papa, but as Henry Nantha. Odd, isn't it? Here is this maiden lady, to use my own father's expression for her, half-educated, who lived a quiet life in London, who never worked for her living and died at the age of 99, writing to her brother of their father as if he were some acquaintance she didn't much like. Her letter is dated early in 1966 and must have been sent to Venice. This is what she said. "You always speak of Henry Nantha as if he were some sort of pillar of society and high morality and all that sort of thing. In contrast to you, as you put it. I know you disliked him as much as the rest of us did, with the exception of poor George. You will say that if he was a more or less absent father and a remote, rather awful figure in the household, that was normal when we were children.